Hello and welcome to the 2025 Dice Exploder Year-End Bonanza. Each year, at the end of the year, we get together some cool people and we talk through a bunch of RPG stuff from the past 12 months. And maybe this year and in the future. I'm changing up the format a little bit this year. I've got two friends with me and we are going to talk about three mechanics looking back on what RPGs were kind of doing in 2025 and maybe before that. And then three more mechanics to ground a conversation in like where we think RPGs are going in the future. And to do that with me, I have Lynn. Do you want to introduce yourself first?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Lynn Cadiga. I am a journalist, a writer, an author, and I am the person that drags Sam to go see such stunning films such as The Running Man and Roof Man. So,
yep.
Yeah.
All the men movies.
All that's the what men we go movies. See. One battle after another. Like, we really just, we go really hard on
banging them out. Yeah.
Man movies. But yeah, I'm here to talk about games because I love games. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you, Sam.
And then, Diogo, do you want to introduce yourself as well?
Sure. I want to say that Running Man is great, and I think it's a great movie for today's audience, and it's very informative. So, yeah, it's a great movie. I saw it recently, too. And
Lynn is making a lot of faces, which to me says that this could turn into an hour-long conversation about The Running Man, which I would enjoy. I also enjoyed that movie. But let's breeze right past that and introduce who you are.
So, I am Diogo Nogueira. I am the creator of Old School Publishing, which I publish my own independent games. I have a podcast called Weird Games and Weirder People, where I talk to creators on the tabletop RPG sphere about what is it they do, how they do it, and how weird we all are. And I'm now the lead game designer at White Wolf, and I'm very excited to be here and talk about games and RPGs, which is I am obsessed with. So, yay!
I am really excited to have the two of you here, and let's just get right into it. Diogo, I wanted to start with you. What backwards-facing mechanic have you brought in? Like, where are RPGs at for you here at the end of 2025, and, like, what represents that?
Well, something that is very dear to me and has been a constant evolution, I think, in the OSR scene, in the indie scene, is having games that give you a lot of tools for you to set up your game and make it easier for the GM or referee to run it. Because for a long time, like especially in the 90s and early 2000s, we had this vision of the Dungeon Master referee being the one that has to set up everything and prepares the story and responsible for all everybody's fun and have to spend hours and hours preparing a campaign or something. And Mythic Bastion comes, one of the latest ones that comes really well structured to help you create a setting that's going to be unique for you, even though everybody's going to use the same book. Like, everyone's going to make their own setting with their own locations and NPCs and opportunities for adventure and all these rumors. And the book is equipped with a lot of inspiration for you to make it your own, and comes with a sheet for you, so it's not something that you have to prepare yourself with a bunch of paper. It's almost like a treat the GM and the referee as a player too. So like, as a player, you have your character sheet, and as the GM there, as the referee, you have a realm sheet for you to use and trigger and do things in your campaign and make it easier for you, not only to create, but to run games with it. So I think it's something that's been growing over years in this sphere.
Yeah, I see in this a lot of trends. Like, we're going to come back to this at the end of the show because I feel like I picked a companion mechanic to this one for talking about where I see this stuff going in the future, too. But I see this as, like, part of a trend of crossover between, like, traditionally OSR adventure-style play and the more, like, story game movement of the past 20 years, where Realm Setup from Mythic Bastion Land feels like this is a game that is got most of its heritage in the OSR movement, in those adventure games. Like, it plays out a lot like that at the table. It's designed by Chris McDowell, very clearly inspired by Into the Odd and all of that. But the Realm Setup stuff feels to me like a take on, like, what Apocalypse World is doing, right? Like, all these tools, as you were saying, like, for GMs to kind of help them set up and get ready at the table and do their prep and not just throwing them to the wolves of, like, good luck, and creating something that is like a procedure and not what the rest of the OSR has been doing of, like, here's an adventure. Now you don't need to do any of that. You don't need procedures for, like, making up a particular realm or a map when someone has just written an entire one for you. And yeah, so I think it's an interesting kind of confluence of different design heritages just coming together.
Now that you mentioned it, it kind of reminds me one of the early things that I saw doing like the setups kind of stuff. And it's one of the games that are very dear to me and have influenced, I think, the way I do my own stuff is like Fiasco, how they set up you know, locations, relationship, characters, and objects, you know, this kind of stuff. They give you very little things, but you can already see much more than they give you, right? Because with small elements and how they interact, the complexity is born from these interactions. So it's nice to see how these different worlds that were apart for so long are kind of talking to each other more and more. Yeah.
Yeah.
This actually reminds me a lot of Incursions in Trophy Dark. Mm. I don't know if you guys have ever played mm-hmm. that game, but when it was published the very first time in the Gauntlet, it included one incursion, and then it included a guide to how to write those incursions, and they held like a contest for people to like write their own incursions. But that was probably one of the first times, and this must have been 2017, 2016, but that was one of the first times that I remember kind of this OSR adventure, like giving you this really clearly prescribed, here's how you build an adventure in this game, and here's why you build that adventure. And it went through like what each step of the incursion, because there's five mm-hmm. levels, are supposed to like represent psychologically and within the minds of your players. It was very good stuff. Mm. Jesse Ross did a really good job with that one.
All right, let's move on to the next one. Lynn, what'd you bring in?
I brought in everyone's favorite game mechanic, the safety tool.
Yeah, great.
The thing that everyone loves and wants to talk about.
I did do like a 90-minute episode on this topic this year.
So you probably have a lot more to say about it than I do. But yeah, I just think that safety tools, people are really reimagining what they can be, what they look like, how they act, and also what they're supposed to do. I think that people are realizing that safety tools don't necessarily keep you safe. They just set expectations.
Yeah.
So I think moving forward, we're going to see a lot more, not inventiveness with safety tools. That's not what I'm trying to say. But we're going to see something that like changes the way that we interact with safety tools as a method of keeping people comfortable and keeping people excited about the game that they're playing.
Can you say more about that? Like, what do you mean in more detail?
So I think that one of the things that I've seen quite a lot, especially Jay Dragon does this quite frequently, is she adds conversation guides within her work where she's very specific about, remember, this is like how to talk to each other as like human beings who love each other and want to play games with each other. And I think that there's this mounting movement where embracing some parts of discomfort, or like realizing that discomfort is this very natural part of life, that people are beginning to use safety tools to also like push boundaries within games themselves. Like one of the games I'm thinking of is Praise the Hawk Moth King,
mm-hmm. yeah.
where it's this very erotic, like kind of disgusting, like pushing the boundaries of good taste game, where like you are playing as dead teenagers who have to like fuck demons in order to like save other people's souls. It's a very weird, messed up game. It's also very well written, and it's a very good game, but it's deliberately built with minimal safety tools because it wants you to determine for yourself where those lines are and to find through exploration and play what is and isn't safe for you.
Yeah, I think we're in a really interesting place with it, where I'm thinking now of a piece y'all just published on Rascal by friend of the show, Serafina, a couple of weeks ago, about Fight Truck. And that piece is this like very, very personal essay about her life experience and her relationship with her parents. And also it's like a call to actively play towards more difficult subject matter because taking those risks is exciting and fruitful, while also like acknowledging that that is dangerous in a way, and that you want to do that carefully. And I'm also thinking of a 2024 piece, I want to say, by McGay Baker, talking about like safety tools are not her preferred nomenclature for what we talk about as safety tools, that mm-hmm. she much prefers the term communication tools for a lot of these reasons, right? Like, safety tools can't keep you safe. There's no such thing as 100% safe play. There's no such thing as like 100% safe, like, conversation with anyone mm-hmm. just like out in the world, right? Like, the important thing is much more, how do you handle things when they go sideways? Like, how do you handle yourself when someone has been hurt, and how do you keep communicating and take care of each other?
Yeah.
I do feel like we're at a place now where people are learning this and not really sure what to do about it. Like, I remember earlier this year, there was a mm-hmm. lot of conversation around Hawk Moth King in the Read the Fucking Manual Discord, a Discord like full of people who really like games that have a lot of sex in them. And it was all these people saying, I really want to play this game. I don't have anyone to play this game with. I don't know how to do that. Like, yeah. Not that I don't know how to do that, but like, I just don't feel like I have the community to do that with. And I think that's maybe a next evolution of this conversation too, is how do you find those people, or how do you play these games with people you are a little bit less familiar with, or do you want to do that at all, and everything there?
Yeah, it's tough because the very nature of play is how you can like transgress the boundaries of rules. Play is pushing up against rules. It's just, that's naturally how it works. So in order to find like a community of trust and a community of people who can buy into a game where you will purposely put yourself on the edge of dangerous situations, that like emotionally is really tough. And I think it's one of those things where perhaps sometimes these games maybe like should not be played. Like, it's okay
yeah,
if
totally.
They're not. But mm-hmm. I think that like the act of playing them is important at the same time. But yeah, I think it's the community, the trust, building up to that. It's something that needs to be done with a lot of conversation, a lot of communication, and a lot of like deliberate work to get to the place where you feel comfortable playing these kinds of games. It can't just be like, we're gonna go to a movie and have a good time. Like, that's not community building in the same way that being a deliberate builder of trust in order to like get to this point where you feel comfortable enough to like play this game together is. I think that some of this does stem from the fact that we are seeing such a crackdown on pornography, on erotic sure. material. There's mm-hmm. a lot happening in the US specifically about credit card banning that kind of content and not allowing sites who host that kind of content, erotica, porn, to get payment, right? So I think that there is a part of games as kind of this counterculture movement just in general that is seeing that and being like, okay, well, how do we fight this in our own way? And yeah. I think that we're seeing people are more willing to embrace things like Bleed. And people are starting to become, again, not that we haven't had this conversation for like 20 years, but people are starting to once again embrace that like Bleed can be a very good thing and can be something that people really seek out when they play games.
Yeah. All right. The backwards looking thing I brought in was Daggerheart. I was going to pick a specific mechanic from Daggerheart, and then I was like, actually, the thing I kind of want to talk about is how like none of the mechanics in this game matter. Like, I don't need to like pick a specific thing for the thing I want to talk about, because Daggerheart is full of like cool mechanics. Like, I think Daggerheart is an improvement on 5th edition D&D for me, right? If I wanted to go back and play that kind of game again. But Daggerheart and Draw Steel are both games that came out this year that have their roots in a particular community, Critical Role for Daggerheart, and Draw Steel from Matt Colville and his YouTube channel, where these games were very large. They were kind of positioning themselves as like 5th edition killers. Like, they wanted to like step up and like step into that slot in the hobby. And I don't know that anyone really expected them to like completely overtake and like displace Dungeons and Dragons mm-hmm. or even take like a huge bite out of it. But the fact that there were two really high profile attempts in the past couple of years feels really notable to me. And the more I thought about it, the more I was particularly interested in the way that both of these games are so attached to their communities. And like, what does that say about what communities in our hobby look like right now? Like, I think we've become very siloed and fractured by the nature of social media and how it has changed. And so, like, all the coolest design stuff is happening in, like, walled gardens on Discords, right? Or in, like, tiny little social communities. And I think in the same way, like, the games that have been inspiring the most exciting new design tech that are, like, pushing forward in new ways are also, like, Mothership. And a couple of years ago, it was Blades in the Dark. It was communities, like, based around a particular game or a particular person. And that, like, I found it interesting that instead of a community, like, forming up around games, like with Mothership or Morkborg or something like that, here we had two games coming out of their communities. That, like, with Critical Role's community and Matt Mercer's community, we kind of have, like, these people that want to play Dungeons and Dragons in a particular way and have come together around that and are now creating a full product in order to do their take on what that looks like. So I don't know exactly where I'm, like, going with all of that, but it feels like something that I've been observing over the past year.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you're describing is the difference between a fandom and a fan club.
Sure.
So a fandom is a group of people who are trying to iterate on a design or an idea, right? So I think that the Borgs, all the Borgs, all of the motherships, that's a fandom, right? They get into the design, they get into the structures, and they tinker and they play and they create new modules, new systems, new games. And then I think that you're also describing here a fan club culture where people are really interested in emulating the play style that they are a fan of. And so it's like a recognition of play desire rather than a recognition or a coalescence around design structures. And I think that you're talking about the difference between, like, a play community and a design community.
Diego, what's your relationship like with D&D at this point?
Well, I probably the edition that I played the most was 3.5, right?
Yeah.
And then I got to college, I stopped playing to do art and stuff because I thought that I had to do that. But when I got my job and started getting some money, I bought all the D&D 4th edition books. Reading them all, they seemed very well made. But when I got them to the table, they played very different from what I remember. Because I played a little bit about, you know, 2nd edition and, like, the Black Blocks, like, Rule Encyclopedia era of Basic. And even 3rd edition, like, was a little bit more dynamic. So 4th edition, like, I played a campaign for a year and a half, and we couldn't finish 3 adventures because every combat would take 5 hours or something.
Yeah,
great.
But then that kind of forced me to look for what else is out there, right? So I discovered, like, the Forge, the more narrative games, and the OSR stuff.
It's interesting to hear you talk about, like, various other traditions that have taken D&D and then been like, this isn't working for me. Like, what are we doing now? And, like, people are just still fucking doing that in 2025, right? Like, that's still what Daggerheart is. It's still what Draw Steel is. It's like, this hobby is just never going to be anything other than people looking at D&D and being like, whoa, this is not working for me anymore. What do I do instead?
And I mean, the game feels very different, so yeah. I always wanted something more gritty, more dark, more adventurous, and less heroic. I like players to be more personal-centered, like, their own goals, and not like, oh, we have to save the world. Like, every time it's like, I gotta save the world. So, like, yeah, I'm kind of tired of saving the world. Like, what do you want to do tonight?
Hey, you! You don't look familiar. First time in this part of the city? I see that sneer on your face. Better wipe it off before I do it for you. This is home. This is the best place you could ever want to be. Whether or not this is where you meant to end up, you found yourself on a rather fortuitous street. You see that corner building down there? 3 floors up. Lamplight Investigative Services. Friends of mine, you ask. Loaded words you're throwing around this evening. Good people is what they are, though. Not a single one of them will admit to being nice. Something about duty, yada yada. A bunch of BS, if I do say so myself. Who am I? No need to worry your pretty little head about that. I'm sure my name will come up in time. But go, see for yourself, 3 floors up, gold-gilded sign. As for Mama, Don't tell him I sent you. She'll know what to do.
All doors are just windows that we can't see through. You ever think about that?
We provide our patrons with anonymity.
Hello, this is Mama Amaretta speaking.
Lamplight Investigations, a Thirsty Sword Lesbian's noir mystery. Full season available now on QueerPG.
Let's switch to talking about looking forward a little bit. So, Diego, what is the first mechanic you brought in there?
I'm talking about some of the games that are exploring a little bit of how board games attract the attention of players to the table, you know, because I'm really interested. I know about how streaming is something very popular and how a lot of people play online, but I'm very interested in games that makes you look at the table. Like, you have to be at the table, you have to touch stuff, you have to play with pieces there, you have to bring in some elements of board games to RPGs and make it a little more tactile and interactive in this way. Mm-hmm. And I think in this world that we are ever more connected and isolated at the same time, we're always talking to someone or always on the internet, right? We're always seeing stuff, but you're a lot more common to play alone, like solo games, or play online and you don't see people.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in see how games are trying to recover this aspect of, yeah, you have to be on the table, you have to touch stuff, you have to be in the presence of other people, because I think it's healthy now more than ever. We have to seek opportunities to be close to people as much as you can. So, you know, Hollows and the Demon Ring now sort of set have things to put on the table that are visual and they're attractive and have your pieces to facilitate play and makes you look at it. And one of my games, Primal Quest, tried to do something like this to at the end of the game, you have to go with people that you played with and you draw together something, you produce something that's kind of a diegetic piece and also something that you can remember that you did on the table, you know?
Yeah, one of my original picks for backward-looking mechanic before I saw you'd picked this, and I thought there was too much overlap, was the idea of box sets. That the past couple of years, we've got the Mouse Ritter box set, we've got the Mothership box set, but even before that, I feel like we were getting a certain kind of designer really interested in like card-based RPGs, like mm-hmm. the Bully Pulpit, like re-releasing Fiasco, or their Desperation a couple of years ago. For the Queen is another card-based one that I know a lot of people have played. And for me, that has been a really cool direction for games to go, both because I think there's a lot of just like interesting design space in that direction. Like, I think the making games more tactile as opposed to like on a million different pieces of paper that you have to keep track of just like makes them potentially easier to play and keep track of too. And then on top of that, all the kind of social stuff that you were talking about. But I didn't want to pick it for forward looking because I feel like in the US, like the tariff situation is like fucking up this direction of design. And that's
true.
Like I have a game coming out next year that has character cards and is kind of card based and maybe wants like a play mat, and I really wanted to do like a boxed version of, and it also just didn't make sense to keep pursuing it because the cost is going up there. And I talked with like publishers who might be interested in it but were not because of that. So I think there's like the energy for this socially is like really there. I think like this is also such a better way to introduce RPGs to people, is when you can attach it more to the idea of a board game that people are probably more familiar with right now. And like, this is what I want to be playing and what I want to be making. I think it's so, like, cards in particular are such a compelling medium. And also, I'm sad that the physical realities of globalization right now are getting in the way of it.
I like the idea of making them more like toys, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. The toyification of the games, I don't know.
There's another related piece to everything you're saying there socially. Of like the past couple of years, something that's become really important to my practice of playing these games is a every other week Monday night in-person meetup at the game store where people just show up and play one-shots. And I found these like box set board gamey kinds of games tend to be pretty good one-shot experiences and lend themselves really well to showing up at that kind of scene. And that kind of event, that kind of scene is really good for creating a sustainable practice of playing the games in person. That, like, if you miss 1 week, everyone is still coming without you, right? Like, the event takes care of itself in a way where, like, if you miss a couple of weeks in a row of your home game, maybe the whole thing just, like, falls apart and you need to, like, set it back up again. And so, yeah, I think that might be another future-looking thing here is, like, more, like, come to the game store, like, let's all bring a larger-than-one table community together.
In Brazil, has been a really, like, a popular games that are set up to be like open table games.
That
you can play one night. Like, I was designing a Sword and Sorcery game, like in a kind of a Lankomer situation. Like, every session is just one night.
Yeah.
So if you show up, your character are doing something that night. But if you don't, maybe he's busy this night. So the next session is going to be just another night, you know. You don't miss an entire adventure. Like, because it's personal. Like, what do you want to do tonight? And they do that tonight and next session is another night.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So Sam and I attend the same group. Every time I go, I try and bring a game. And the games that I brought that have done really well are stuff like The Zone, Revolt, Hearts Blazing. I hold up a little box and I'm like, I'm going to teach you what to do. And everyone's like, sold. It's so easy to just bring something very physical and show people, like, here it is, a real thing, not just a book, I promise. And it works really well. Mm-hmm. People are very eager for it.
Yeah. Lynn, what have you got for us looking forward?
So, Sam, Diogo, as you know, I spent 30 days playing as High Gardener Otso in Over Under, which is this Discord-based play-by-post LARP mega game for Mothership Month. It was wild. It was so intense. There were, I think, about 1,000 people actually playing the game and 1,600 people like in the Discord. It was way too big. It was very intense, very emotional. It took a huge emotional toll on a lot of people who were playing. But the result of that, which happened mid-October to mid-November of this year, was everyone came away from it thinking, I want to do that too. So now we're seeing tons and tons, dozens of Discord servers pop up where people are adapting the rules of the games that they want to play to a Discord play-by-post forum-based text format, which I think is really cool. I think we're going to see a lot of those happen in 2026. Hopefully we'll see more games supported by companies.
Supporting that,
Over Under was directly, like, financially supported by Sean McCoy and Tuesday Night Games for Mothership Month. So they were able to pay moderators, pay the designer.
Oh, nice.
So it was this really fascinating experience, not just as a player, but as someone who's, like, really interested in the industry of gaming and the industry of game design, where it feels like such a success, right? And to misquote my friend Caleb Zane Hewitt, writer of Triangle Agency, who was also playing the game with me, he was fond of saying they caught lightning in a bottle, they were expecting rice. And it was just this incredible moment of community and free-form gaming that I think is going to inform a lot of the ways that people try and engage with community and build community in 2026. And I think a lot of that comes from a little bit about what you were saying, Diogo, where people want keepsakes, right? They want something that feels very physical, that feels very permanent. And games are kind of, by their nature, pretty ephemeral. Like, you sit down, you have this event, the event is over, you leave. And in something like a Discord, everything is there. You can go back and reread games. You can reread the scenes that you had with these people. And I think that there is something, even though it is digital, that is
there's a record there, right?
Yeah.
You can look back and you can remember stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like a journal.
Very anti-ephemeral. And okay, I think that people are also leaning into the idea of, like, wanting to improve. They want to improve how they play games. And writing is always a practice, right? So if you write and you write with people and you learn more, you can more clearly think through what your character is going to do when you have time to respond. And I think that people are really like going to learn how to be better storytellers and better gamers by taking it a little bit slower in their games, right? Anyway, yeah. So I think that there's like an interesting avenue forward where discussion, collaboration, practice, and this kind of like recorded game becomes much more popular in 2026.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about this also. If you had not picked this, I would have picked this. I feel like I'm going to certainly do at least one episode on Over Under in 2026, but it was such a like profound experience. And part of that was because it was poorly run, I think, in ways that like really affected people. And part of that was because it was magical because of the way it was run and like because of everything that was set up with it. And I think there's nothing that's more catnip to a game designer than this is great, but I know how to do it better. And Over Under was just so perfect for that feeling for a lot of people. Like, yeah. I loved this. And also, I think I can do it better. And so many people, I think, are looking to recapture the best feelings that they had from the experience. And I really hope that as I mean, I'm one of these sickos, but I hope as all the Over Under sickos like look towards doing that, that they look around the other people and other communities that have been doing really similar things in the past. Like, I think at the start of Over Under, there were a lot of people being like, I've never experienced anything like this before. Like, what is this? This is new. No one's ever done this. And in fact, like, people role-playing in Discords and on forums and in IRC channels has been going on for as long as those things have existed. And I also remember there was a particular large server-wide event that was going on that was causing some drama, and I was describing it to my friend who was not in the game but who was very familiar with Blockbuster LARPs. And I got like a quarter of the way into the story and they were like, oh, yeah. And then XYZ things like happened, right? And I was like, oh, yeah, how did you know that? And they were like, yeah, because that's always what happens at this kind of situation in Blockbuster LARPs.
Yeah.
And so I think that like I think that there's a lot to learn from these existing communities in and pulling into this, but I also think that like OSR people and story game people like bringing new ideas and new energy to those old communities, like bringing forward what Blockbuster LARP people have been doing and like trying to see what happens when it becomes digital, or trying to bring more of their sensibilities and rules and all that kind of stuff to the sort of like live role playing on Discord and that particular strand of play by post. I think that there is a lot of room for us to learn from this medium to get exploded by us, all these things to like mix together in really exciting ways.
Yeah.
Because
each people will see those things a little bit differently. Even though they're like doing the same thing, they all come with different baggage and will interpret the same thing in different ways.
Exactly.
And then we probably can all learn a little bit from each other. Like, you know, still like an artist, just get all those experiences, mixing it up and see what sticks, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah, I think that Over Under very specifically was really interesting to see the OSR play culture and the story game play culture really clash. And clash is maybe not the correct word, but come together in really interesting ways to make something very new. Because
collide is maybe a good word for you.
Yeah, they collided because, of course, the game was built as a mega game. It was never intended to be a LARP. And then as soon as people started joining, they started playing in character. And I'm just like, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. That was literally what happened in this situation. But yeah, I think that in the future, I would hope, again, to what you said, Diogo, where people are learning from each other, and to what you said, Sam, let's learn from LARPs. They've solved a lot of these problems. They've been doing this for like 20, 30 years. Like, let's get Jeep for Nordic LARPs. Let's figure out ways to enact a more structured play culture within these technological spaces. But yeah, I think we'll see a lot of it in 2026.
I mean, listen, the LARP culture is like they've certainly thought about a lot of these ideas a lot longer than people in the OSR and story game communities have. And also, like, they've got their own drama. They've got their own hangups. They've got their own, like, system matters kinds of debates that are like, maybe we can come in and contribute to and, like, ignore. Or, like, much as there's, like, a ton there that I think it will be really fruitful for people exploring post-over-under style games to work with.
Yeah, sort of my last idea about this. It'll be interesting because there is a part of this that is kind of violently anti-system in its own way, where you're really only limited by the constraints of the technology and whether or not a mod will come up and slap you on the wrist. And I think that's really fun. I think, again, we're seeing a lot of the ways in which people are pushing against rules and pushing against the ways that other people have told them to play, because play is what you do when you have fewer barriers, when you have less rules. So I think it's fascinating to see, like, what rituals, what rules are allowed and what rules you are able to push against by using other rules and breaking other rules. I like rules, guys. I think they're fun.
Yeah. They help. They put a direction on the fun. Like, it's something. Rules as toys. Like, I like to see rules as toys. Like, how can I play with this rule? Like, if my game is about seduction, how I make a toy about seduction that we can play and this kind of stuff. So, yeah, I love rules in some way.
I found it really interesting in Over Under where someone pointed out early on that, like, okay, in D&D, if you give people a bunch of rules for violence, then, like, the game becomes about violence, right? And what happened in Over Under is there was a Discord bot that had some hard-coded in rules for currency and money. And so the entire game became about hustling. That, like, everyone was just, like, trying to make money. And that in a lot of ways, that was a toy for people to play with, was the game's economy. And that is what you saw. It felt less like people playing with the rules of the game and more like this toy had been dropped into a Discord along with a cultural expectation for role-playing. And, like, where does that take us? I want to call out a couple of things here. First, if people are interested in learning more about LARP, I did like a 12-episode series on LARP this year, so go back in the Dice Explorer archives and check that shit out.
Okay.
And second of all, like, I said I had problems with the way that Over and Under was poorly organized, and I do stand by that, but I also really want to give those guys credit really explicitly. Like, I think Sean and Sam, like, the work that they did do, like, none of what made the game magical would have been possible without the stuff that they were doing, and I think that they learned a lot and handled themselves really well publicly. So I just want to make sure they don't feel like I'm shitting on them. Over Under was fabulous. I want to take a lot of the ideas that we have been talking about over the past 45 minutes and maybe try to tie them together in my last looking forward mechanic here. This is going to be most similar to where we started with Realm Setup and Mythic Bastion Land. I want to talk about Apocalypse World, 3rd edition, hard zones. So this is a mechanic where it's new to Burned Over, if you know that version of Apocalypse World, or to 3rd edition here, where they're basically like, here's 10 locations in an environment's biome for you to play around with, right? So Lynn and I are playing in a game of Apocalypse World right now that's set in the Frozen Wastes, and one of the locations on the Frozen Wastes is Halter's Town, which is a town built above a frozen lake where they drill down into the lake and fish giant demonic fish.
Cool.
And another one is the Shatters, which is a vast plain of snowy wastes where weird storms happen and stuff like that. And so you have all these, you just have some, like, baseline setting material to work with in your story game. And I think this feels pretty not new to me. I mean, other, like, huge games have done this, right? Blades in the Dark comes with a huge setting, even though it feels very story gamey. It comes with just, like, all this specific stuff, all these factions. That in a lot of ways, you could run Blades in the Dark without any of the rules, just pulling the sort of, like, module flavor of the game, right?
Absolutely.
And also, like, Mythic Bastion Land, I was originally going to use Mythic Bastion Land's 72 knights as the, like, starting point for this conversation rather than the hard zones thing of, like, the game just comes with, here's 72 player characters, and they don't feel like classes in the same way. They feel like full people. Wanderhome, another game I feel like is doing this, right? It's, like, 20 pages of rules and then, like, hundreds of pages of tables of stuff that you can, like, pull into your game. And I feel like the past few years we've seen the OSR and NSR, like, kind of adventure game communities do, like, a ton of cool innovating around what does it look like to bring pre-generated material to the game text, right? Like, what do modules look like? And what do, like, games with kind of modules inside of them, like, baked in, like, bring to the table? Like, what can we do with all of that? And I am hoping in the future, like, the reason I'm putting this in my forward-looking thing is I think it's finally time for story games to start figuring out how to do that shit ourselves, too. That, like, in the way that, like, Over Under was a game that was kind of like, here's some, like, characters at the boss level, here's some loose war game rules, and then here's, like, the Prospero's Dream, like, a pound of flesh setting material for you to just, like, run with, and then that's what people did, whether that was the intent of the authors or not. Like, that's really cool. That says to me that you can, like, just put all that shit in your game and, like, all that flavor in your game, and that can be, like, a load-bearing part of your game. Like, you can take Apocalypse World and make it better by saying, don't just, like, invent the setting material yourself. Here's 10 sick locations for your setting of Apocalypse World. And I would really love to see more of the story game people who have, I think, these great systems, who have, like, great tools for telling particular kinds of stories, and to bring in, here's not just, like, your game for telling some noir story. Here's a game for telling this noir story. Here's the 30 people involved in this noir story and what this mystery is. And here's some, like, PBTA style rules for interacting with all of that. I think that just that specificity of material is really effective at the table and is something I hope we see story game people starting to take and build on.
Feels very plug and play too, like people beginning, like, constructing something, even though they have tools to help, like this framework and stuff. Maybe they just want to see how it's played so they can do something with it.
Yeah.
So if they have examples there, they feel like, oh, this is the kind of stuff that they can do with this. This is the kind of adventures, the kind of setups, the kind of city or relationships that they can set up with these tools. And it feels very plug and play. Like, you can just get the game, put it on the table, and start without having to grow to those steps.
Yeah.
It's easy to onboard people, I think.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
totally.
I think that there are some story games that do already have this. And I think that you're right to see more. Slow Knife, for example, has like three or four different specific settings that you can play with. Dialect comes with, you know, four or five different
It's like 15.
Modules.
It's a lot of them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It is a lot. It's a ton. And I mean, even something like Trophy Dark, right? Comes with a ton and ton and ton and ton. Dialect. Yes. So I think that a part of this is not just embracing it, but also a matter of scope.
Yeah.
Like, if an indie game or a story game can figure out how to do that without having 72 nights, you know, I think that, that's probably more of a limiting factor than the desire to create these sorts of modular systems that you can then plug stuff into.
And, like, there are plenty of people, as you say, like, doing this, right? Like, I don't want to say that this is not happening. I'm thinking about Xenia's Wonder Tales is the latest Bully Pulpit game that I'm really excited to receive in my mailbox, which is 18 cards per playset, and it, like, tells one fairy tale, and it's a very specific fairy tale, you know? All that kind of specificity has been around and will continue to be around. But I do think, like, so much of the energy that I have seen in the hobby over the past year, year and a half has been with this kind of material, specifically in the, like, NSR movement. And I just think the story game people are finally starting to look over there and be like, oh shit, that rules. Like, and I think maybe we're going to get, like, a boom of this kind of thing into the future. On that note, before we, like, totally close off here, something we've done in the past on these end of year episodes is, like, look back at something that each of us were proud of over the course of the year. So, Diogo, like, what's something that you did in 2025 that's games related that you're proud of?
Yeah, well, I put that in the document that we kind of prepared. It was, for me, something I was proud of is to get back into writing and make my thing and working on the second edition of my first game. Because in 2024, like, my life was in, like, an upheaval. And I thought I would never write games or draw anything again. And I was happy by the end of February to finally get over the stuff that was kind of blocking me, and I was able to get back to writing, and I was able to write every day and draw stuff and have new ideas again and be excited to create new stuff.
Yeah. Lynn, what about you?
I'm really proud of Rascal.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm really proud of Rascal. We got nominated for the Diana Jones Award this year, and then we lost it. Journalism really lost this year in a lot of ways, but Rascal's doing good. And I'm really, really proud of the kind of work that we do and the community we've created, and the people who support us are just really incredible. And I think that it's something that will last a long time. Also, I did a lot of writing this year. I published my first book at the beginning of this year. And here I also...
I got a moth eater on my counter right here. Look at that.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, the thing I was proud of this year was an episode of this very show called After Image, City of Winter. So After Image was a new series that I kind of put together that is trying to do actual play adjacent. Like, it's like game recaps, trying to like convey to an audience through an audio medium like what a particular moment at the table was like and what the emotional experience of that moment was like. Very much pulling from like This American Life style, like just personal essays or like personal memoir almost in the writing of these things. And I've done two of them. I'm really proud of how they came out. This one in particular, like a lot of people listened to, I got a lot of compliments on, and that kept me going when the other writing I was doing this year was a huge pain in the ass. So I don't know, that was cool. It's been a good year for me with a lot to be proud of. I'm really happy with the state of Dice Exploder right now. And part of that's thanks to the two of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here and honored to be among such amazing people. You know, Rascal is really something amazing and important in our community. And like your podcast, exploring game design in all sorts of ways and going all over the place, it's awesome to see. Because sometimes, as you said, like we can get really into our niche and see mm-hmm. only what is surrounding us, and having this opportunity to look beyond your frontiers is very important. So thank you very much.
I mean, thanks for being here and being one of those horizons for us to look over into, you know. That's it. We did it. We talked for an hour. Look at us. You can find Lynn and Diogo on Blue Sky. Links in the show notes. Subscribe to Rascal News at rascal.news and listen to Weird Games and Weirder People wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder or on the Dice Exploder Discord, and you can find my games at sdunnewald.itch.io. Our logo is designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. Thanks to you for listening, and I'll see you next year.